Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 96, section 1. We got into the section a little ways. It's on old single column, page 1054, and it's the 11th paragraph. It's the paragraph after the list, and it's little a footnote one about Jehovah. That paragraph that starts up to about 2000 BC. Okay, before we get started, let's get ourselves positioned in the middle of this section again. Recall that they must, methodically step through the primary God names, if you will, that the Hebrews used or were very closely tied to, because they want you to have a basic understanding of what is going to be Moses's predicate of God concepts, and what's the basic God concepts of the ragtag bunch of people that he's going to try to whip into a nation when they head out of Egypt. And so they step through that list. I'll just remind you that you've got foundationally, of course, you've got Yahweh, that is going to be this word that is going to evolve endlessly over many, many, many centuries, even millennia. But it starts with, starts being a designation for literally, the fetish spirit of that volcano in the Sinai. So it starts very, very primitive as just a nature spirit concept, and eventually is going to attempt to designate, the creator of an infinite universe. So it's a long journey between those two. Then, of course, there's El Elyon, that basic God Most High concept that Machaventa put into play. And another important one is El Shaddai, which is the name that is going to embody the important elements coming into Judaism from Egypt. Right? The Menemope Akhenaten teachings, as well as the concept of providence. Obviously, righteousness, like we talked about, will definitely be there with El Shaddai. And then also just to mention, don't forget about the Elohim concept that is coming more from the stronger revealed to Andite tradition. That comes into play from Mesopotamia, especially for the Hebrews when they're in exile in Babylonia during the 6th century BC, that plural, that vestigial Trinity concept that is Elohim, is what's in the first creation story in Genesis. In the beginning, Elohim, not Yahweh, created the heavens and the earth. And then as soon as you get to the second creation story, then it's Yahweh in that second creation story. And then they also reminded us about that term Jehovah, which is, as I said, not to go through all those details again, but when you combine the respectful vowel marks of Adonai, as you're supposed to say, because you can't say the too sacred to say name Yahweh. So you got the consonants of Yahweh and the vowel marks of Adonai. If you put those two together, you get this other name. And we talked about how the revelators make a point of mentioning that because it does end up being a term that's used. In the latter part of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, especially, to embody, as they say there, the completed concept of Yahweh, you know, taking that Yahweh concept to as complete a rationalized end as you can, and maybe it is time to let go of that spirit, that volcano god name, and just use a different name. And I just a little aside, I was commenting there at the end about the American Standard Version, following the King James, skipping over a lot of details, but kind of in American context, you go from the King James to the American Standard at the beginning of the 20th century. That American Standard Version, I was trying to remember, I thought it was 1906, but it's actually 1901, so it literally is at the beginning of the 20th century. It was 1901 is when that American Standard Version was produced as a follow-on to the King James here in America. And they used Jehovah in that Bible. So that, besides traditions, that get codified like the Jehovah's Witnesses using Jehovah, that official use of it instead of Lord, like if you look in the King James or if you look in the Revised Standard, in the New International Version, whatnot, you're likely to have capital L, small caps, O-R-D, Lord, whenever Yahweh appears in the Hebrew Scriptures, because of that Adonai thing I was just talking about. But anyway, just to, for those who are keeping track of little details like 1901 or 1906, it is 1901. So that's where we left off, is not only giving you what you need immediately for the Moses story, but taking the opportunity, like with Jehovah, mentioning Jehovah there, to just flesh out that list a little bit more and remind you that, even though most people today will not, invoke the name El Shaddai, it's still invoked, but it's not that common these days, you should appreciate that your concept of God is in part coming from those who worshiped El Shaddai and what their God concept was. Part of that got blended into your God concept that was handed to you as you began to grow up. So all of this is important for you to understand where your God concept came from and just how heterogeneous an origin, what you think is a perfectly pure God concept that you were handed, after millennia of religious people developing it. It's quite a polyglot, heterogeneous hodgepodge that's been woven together by really, really smart people to appear to be a seamless monolithic construct, but it isn't at all. There's a lot of tensions within all of our God concepts because of this. And that reminds you of the first paragraph of the book, right? If you go to the first paragraph of the foreword, and they say, okay, let's think about these ideas of God that you have. Step back. We're not saying that there isn't a God, so you don't have to start hyperventilating, but you need to think about giving it a serious upgrade, because it's a pretty haphazard, in many ways, kind of arbitrary construct that you're holding on to white knuckle, certain that God told you that himself, and you know, maybe you need to back away and consider improving that. Maybe the Egyptian concept of providence could use an upgrade, right? Right? Yeah. You know, you didn't know that came from El Shaddai, right? Whenever you thought about providence, but it did, right? And people a really long time ago came up with that. You know, has there been? Did Jesus say anything that might cause the concept of providence to need an upgrade, for instance? Or can we just keep going with what the Egyptians did countless millennia ago? Not to mention the fifth epical revelation. What does it have to say about providence? Okay, so those sorts of things. It's, you know, there's a truth flowing through all that for you. It isn't just historical boilerplate that you got to wade through here. All right, so the rest of this section now, section one here, they want to talk about this a little bit, flesh out some of those details that they gave you the PowerPoint bullet points there for up front. So let's see what they say next here.
Up to about 2000 BC, Mount Sinai was intermittently active as a volcano, occasional eruptions occurring as late as the time of the sojourn of the Israelites in this region. The fire and smoke, together with the thunderous detonations associated with the eruptions of this volcanic mountain, all impressed and awed the Bedouins of the surrounding regions and caused them greatly to fear Yahweh. This spirit of Mount Horeb later became the god of the Hebrew Semites, and they eventually believed him to be supreme over all other gods.
Okay, we'll pick that up directly when we get to Moses and their wanderings out of Egypt. But you see, you know, that's what they're referring to when, you know, when they said, as late as the time of the sojourn of the Israelites in this region, that's what they're referring to. When Moses brings them there, Moses gets a delightful little exclamation point to work with, courtesy of the volcano. The Lord speaks, I don't have to convince you of anything. You can hear it yourself, it was very handy for Moses to have that volcano still, going off some and happening to go off while they were there. Obviously not a cataclysmic eruption, but enough to make the point, right? This just wasn't Moses, jiggling air molecules here. The Lord himself is behind this.
Are you suggesting that Moses would resort to propaganda?
Yeah, we'll get to Moses and how pragmatic he had to be in a little bit here. If there's purists listening, gird thy loins. Because you thought that the Apostle Paul had to make a number of compromises, wait till you read about Moses. Effective people have to make compromises. Remember, we talked about that. Abner wouldn't make compromises, and that's why he was not effective. Matter of fact, he was counter-effective. He produced a whole problematic additional religion in contrast to Christianity because he was so uncompromising. All right, so up to 2000 BC, right? In other words, right up prior to Machaventa coming. So I kind of remember we are reading about the consequences of Machaventa coming here. So they're reminding you that that definitely when Machaventa was stepping into a context where the Bedouin Semites had a very, very definitive volcano god concept. It was being reinforced on a regular basis while he was there, while Machaventa was here on the planet, and obviously that's not going to dissipate very quickly at all, because it was so definitively reinforced in such recent past. So that Yahweh thing, okay, remember that was the first thing in the list. So they're starting with that first item in the list. The Yahweh element was very definitive. It wasn't some distant memory or anything. It was a very tangible thing that Machaventa had to consider, and what he was putting forward, definitely Moses is going to have to deal with the very reinforced belief in the volcano god. Let's see here. Anything else there? Remember the fire and smoke, the pillar of fire and the pillar of smoke and all that sort of stuff, right? I mean, all that is in play because of that active volcano. Okay?
The Canaanites had long revered Yahweh, and although many of the Kenites believed more or less in El Elyon, the super god of the Salem religion, a majority of the Canaanites held loosely to the worship of the old tribal deities. They were hardly willing to abandon their national deities in favor of an international, not to say an interplanetary, god. They were not universal deity-minded, and therefore these tribes continued to worship their tribal deities, including Yahweh and the silver and golden calves, which symbolize the Bedouin herders' concept of the spirit of the Sinai volcano.
Right, so obviously that will come into play again. Yeah, that wonderful clarification of where does the whole golden calf thing come in, and it has nothing to do with, the way it's depicted, like they're worshiping some grotesque, demon god or something like this. No, they're worshiping Yahweh, in his literal, nature, spirit, nature god sense as a volcano god when they're doing the golden calf thing, So Moses doesn't have a problem with him worshiping Yahweh. He just has a problem with him worshiping the old, very material, minded notion of God. He's trying to use the same name and give it this whole conceptual upgrade. It's like, should he really be surprised that if he's using the same name, that they would go back to worshiping that name in the way they've always worshiped that name? Yeah, so, it's an interesting trade-off. He decided he needed to keep the same name, but then that means he's going to have all the more trouble breaking him free from, being so literal, of the mountain fetish, right? And trying to get them to actually think of a god on high, right? Rather than a god at eye level, right? Inside the rumbling mountain in front of them. All right. Remember, you've got that general region there. Later on you call Palestine, but it's Canaan. And you have a lot of different Canaanite tribes. Eventually, when Moses leads them into the Promised Land, into Canaan, you've got not only does his people represent a complex mishmash, but you're stepping into an even more complex diversity of tribal gods and pulling out his people, worship this way, worship this god, all of that complexity, all those different Canaanite peoples, including amongst the Canaanites or the Kenites, right? So it goes from very, very crude sorts of ideas to the people that are holding on to the best ideas that Machaventa presented, right? And everything in between, all under this big umbrella of the Canaanites. And you got to love that. Not to say an interplanetary god, yeah, that hardly needs to be said. Right. I mean, how
they didn't even know there were planets.
How many people alive today are, you know, broad-minded enough to worship an interplanetary god? Right.
Well, there's no life on other planets.
Yeah, right. That's the way you conveniently avoid this religiously, is you decree that there's no life on other planets.
One planet, one sun.
Yeah. The more, you know, during the 20th century, we, at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, thought of life on other planets was absolutely absurd. By the end of the 20th century, almost everyone believes that there has to be life on lots of other planets. Right. So it would 180 degrees over the course of the century, right? And you know, we all know that religion is having, you know, sort of forced to have to start to think about this. It's like, well, how would that work if there's life on other planets? Did Jesus go to the other planets? You know, or what's the deal with that? I mean, are they all damned to hell on every other planet? Only our planet is saved? I mean, you know, you have all these arguments going on. Because they give lip service to an infinite God, but no, they still have a puny God, right? I mean, they still basically have the God that fits in the burning bush, you know, on Mount Sinai. You know, it's very difficult for the best of people today to really get to an interplanetary God. And let alone say something like, well, I guess the logical thing, there would have to be other bestowal suns. Yeah. Blasphemy, right? Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
I was just thinking yesterday, the Boulder School, the Arantia School, mm-hmm. we had a speaker. He was into UFOs,
uh-huh.
and he said that Jesus came on a spaceship.
Right, so you bring in a technological sensibility, you know, UFOs are kind of a point of fixation about, right, and then you start to reinterpret everything in a UFO model, you know, Ezekiel is seeing a UFO and et cetera, right? You can have two people standing side by side. And there being something mysterious in the sky, and the traditionalist sees the sun spinning and rose petals falling, and the person standing right next to him, that's a UFO enthusiast, sees a perfect silver disc, you know, in the sky, right? And they're standing next to each other looking at the same spot in the sky. I mean, we have these concept frames that we not only think in, but that we perceive in with our senses. Right? I mean, you know, we think that our senses are just automatically objective, but of course they aren't at all. There's nothing automatic about objectivity at all. And you know that you're not seeing the thing out there at all. You're seeing a representation in your mind. You know, and setting aside how did the representation get there, but you know, nonetheless, you're seeing this representation, and it's not a representation that's chiseled in the stone of matter or spirit substance, right? It's a form in a very fluid energy called mind energy, which is subject to easy manipulation by your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. And you can morph it at will, literally. Right? So, you know, it's very difficult to get people to not, you know, cloud their God concepts with the latest sort of cultural frame that they've been raised in. Like if they were raised to be really interested in UFOs because of science fiction and whatnot, you know, they're going to start seeing everything like that.
Well, my point more was that it was kind of funny to say it to the Eurasian
group. Yeah, right. But then, of course, you can go, well, okay, there's a little measure of truth, you know, in the same way that, you know, the Sumerian king list says that the first people came down from heaven, right, to start the Sumerian king list. It's like, well, Adam and Eve did come down, and right, you know, and a person today will think they came down in a spaceship, right, you know, and you know, people in the ancient past maybe thought that they walked down the sunbeam, right. or whatever.
So why would he walk down a plank like that guy in that movie, that alien?
Right. It's just...
the spaceship opens and he comes on a...
Yeah, the
platform.
See, all the reason I'm dwelling on this, and I know I'm kind of going beyond what you originally were thinking about, but it just makes the point, like I was making up front. How are you going to achieve an objective concept of God from the fifth epical revelation? Think about how much is in the way of that. Very innocently on your part, you just have. All the traditional ways that you've been taught about thinking about God, and then you've got newfangled things that come in with science fiction and stuff and quantum mechanics and what have you and the Big Bang. And can you actually think about what's being said in here independent of all that? Or are you going to cloud everything that it says in here with the Big Bang model?
Maybe the first time you read it, after you do it for a while, it definitely evolves.
Yeah.
If
you're being courageous, you'll notice that you begin to evolve. The not so courageous, the more timid souls kind of don't evolve. They kind of just stay in that initial frame. Machaventa could evolve some of his listeners, others not so much, right? And everything in between. Right? That's just the way it is. All right. So, but yeah, you gotta chuckle it, and not to say an interplanetary God. Mm-hmm. You just can't go in one step from something very, very minusculely tribal, and localized geographically, to something, that's even universal over the planet, let alone into infinity, right? That's just, you can't do that in one step and in some evolutionary process with mankind. You're not going to do it inside of yourself either, from you the little kid to you the adult. It's not going to happen overnight. You're going to have to kind of do what they're going to be talking about was done in an evolutionary sense within yourself. You're going to kind of start with many gods, even if you're parents were pounding monotheism into you. You still don't think really like that inside as a little kid. You're going to think in many gods, and then slowly one god is going to get elevated above the others in your mind, and eventually you're more genuinely, independently monotheistic yourself, as opposed to just parroting something that you heard from your parents or whatever, right? That you sort of have discovered it yourself. It's just part of the process. Okay, what else do they say here?
The Syrians, while worshiping their gods, also believed in Yahweh of the Hebrews. For their prophet said to the Syrian king, "Their gods are gods of the hills. Therefore they were stronger than we. But let us fight against them on the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they."
What was I just saying about localized geographically? And how literally they took it? I mean, obviously, if you fight the Hebrews in the hills, you're going to lose, even if your armies are bigger and everything, and better equipped and better trained. I mean, you're going to lose because, they've got the God of the hills on their side. But, if we can, somehow trick them into meeting us in battle out on the plain where our God reigns, then they're toast. I mean, that's what you're working with, not only a very small group favor-finding God, but one who is bound to a place, Their God couldn't, take a little hike up in the hills and go one-on-one with Yahweh. No, I mean, that was just not possible. Because, see, they're kind of, you can see how much they're starting as nature gods, right? They're gods tied to matter. Right? They're not thought of as being transcendent to the matter. Right? He's glued to the plane. He can't transcend the plane and go into the hills.
And these military contests weren't just to determine who was superior militarily. It was a contest of whose God is most powerful.
Right. If you actually got to the situation where both sides thought that their God was present there, right, then it becomes not which army is stronger, but which God is stronger. And when the army loses, they will literally admit, yep, our God is a lesser God. Our people will now worship your God because you've proven, you know, that Yahweh is a greater God. I mean, this is one of the, you know, reasons why the Hebrews had to defeat a lot of armies, because those peoples, those armies would then admit that, yep, Yahweh is above my God. See, it's that process of moving towards monotheism. So the Most High Observer, right, that rules in the kingdoms of men, is going to be working with that, right? He's not going to say, well, I'm not going to feed into their delusions that, you know, that their God favors them and, you know, one God is stronger than another God. You know, no, he works with that. It's like that. So they believe, you work with that. Like I said, if you're a purist, you have a hard time being pragmatic like that. Right? If you have a strong bias to your spiritual consciousness, you don't want to compromise like that and let them just believe and work with that system. And you're going to get right in their face and scream at them about how stupid their thought is. Right? And that's, and it's that sort of self-righteous tendency that, you know, gave Abner problems, gave the Ermia, you know, camp problems, etc. You know, you just, that unwillingness in the name of purity, in the name of sincerity to your unity consciousness, your spiritual consciousness, you know, unwilling to compromise and to accept facts for what they are and work with them. Having the wisdom to do something good, even though the facts are limited. All right. Let's keep going. Yep.
As man advances in culture, the lesser gods are subordinated to a supreme deity. The great Jove persists only as an exclamation. The monotheists keep their subordinate gods as spirits, demons, fates, nereids, fairies, brownies, dwarfs, banshees, and the evil eye. The Hebrews passed through henotheism and long believed in the existence of gods other than Yahweh, but they increasingly held that these foreign deities were subordinate to Yahweh. They conceded the actuality of Chemosh, god of the Amorites, but maintained that he was subordinate to Yahweh.
So just, you know, some lots of kind of words and proper names here that may not be so familiar. Again, that henotheism, it's hen because hen is the Greek word for the number one. Right? So it's henotheism, like we talked before, I think last time, right? What the idea there, instead of the many theism, right, of polytheism, right? You have this idea that there's one that's above the others, and you know, for you, you know, from your perspective, you worship that one, but you don't deny the existence of others, right? You haven't gone all the way to monotheism, you know, even though you're only worshiping one God, that isn't technically monotheism because you acknowledge, you know, the others. Like they're pointing out, the Amorite god, Chemosh, you know, it's C-H like Chris, you know, not ch, but like a K, Chemosh. See, they're not denying that there is no Chemosh. No, they think there's a Chemosh. They just think Yahweh's above. Right? And so, you know, when you're reading the Old Testament, you know, as they're kind of pointing out here, you know, you can see this. The places in the Old Testament where it's still in that older henotheistic mode. You know, but then eventually you've got them thinking more and more in terms of, no, there just isn't any other God. You know, and the one and only God, see, it's one thing to say one, it's another thing to say one and only, right? That one and only God that, you know, is the God we call Yahweh. Then, of course, when you have multiple monotheistic peoples, then you've got the challenge for them to recognize that the one and only God that they use a certain name for and the other people use another name for, logically, you know, those are two names for the same one and only God. But that's a very difficult step, you know, because remember, people naturally, you know, in ancient times, you know, because of this naturalness, put, you know, a literal spirit substantiveness into the name, right? You know, Allah isn't just a name. No, I mean, it's a lot more than just a name, you know, what we call the one God. It's like, no, you know, I mean, no, the one and only God can only be called that name. That name is sacred. That name is the spirit substance of the God himself, right? You can't just call him El Shaddai or El Elyon or whatever. I mean, the name is the substance of the God himself. Right, so it gets very difficult.
Well, we often have many Christians in the spirit of generosity think, well, Allah's just God by another name. But followers of Allah may not share the same generosity when it comes to...
Right. The better in each religion can kind of, see, get into the philosophic frame encompassing your religious consciousness and recognize logically, oh, okay, it is just another name for the same God. But not the kind of more literal, natural believers. Right? You got to, most people can't achieve that level of unnaturalness, right, to see the name of their God that objectively. Right? They take it very personally, very literally. And if you don't call it by such and so name, I mean, not only are you calling it by the wrong name, you should be executed for using any other name. They take it very seriously. When you're thinking, how do I spread the fifth epical revelation? Yes, I mean, you're dealing with stuff that, you know, insurmountable, right? The very fact that their favorite name, you know, isn't the name in here proves the book is false. And you don't have to even read anything else, right? I mean, maybe their favorite name doesn't even appear in the Urantia book. So all I have to do is just do a word search. When they find that their favorite name doesn't appear anywhere in the book, they know they don't even have to read one sentence in the book. It's by definition a false text. Right? If it was a valid text, it would have the word Baha'u'llah in it. Period. End of story. Right? I mean, it's something as simple as that.
They have a whole chapter on the name of God.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's quite interesting.
Right. Yeah. So this issue is important to keep in mind what you're struggling with when you try to spread truth. Okay. When they give you that list there of all the spirit notions. Well, first of all, Jove. You know, like by Jove, right? You know, that's what the exclamation they're talking about there, right? Who's Jove? What do you normally, except for in that exclamation, what do you normally call that god? That's Sky Father.
Jove?
No. Jupiter. Right. Jove is Jupiter.
Like Zeus.
Like Zeus, yes. Right. Well, I gave you a hint. Yeah, which Sky Father? Right. It's the Roman Sky Father, not the Greek Sky Father Zeus, but it's the same Sky Father, right? The same Andite Sky Father. So you've got that. You know, he goes from, you know, this is something that was a complete lifestyle solution for certain people at one time, now is totally forgotten except people completely unwittingly just using it in that exclamation, you know, not having any idea what they're even talking about when they say by Jove. Okay. That's the point they're trying to make, you know, how something that was everything at one time becomes almost nothing eventually. Right? Nereids, those are the sea nymph daughters of Nereus? Mm-hmm. Mm, yes, sea nymphs. Fascinating stuff. And, you know, brownies are little brown elves, hence the name brownies, you know, et cetera. Banshees, you know, if you know, you know, I think everyone's probably kind of familiar. Remember what, you know, why do banshees wail? You know, they're supposed to be indicating someone's about to die, right? So you hear the banshees wail, right? Because the spirits in ghost land, spirit land, they know all about that dying stuff, right? See, so the, you're getting a warning of that. Yeah, and then, you know, remember we talked about the evil eye. This is just to remind you, going, what evil eye? That's not a spirit or a demon or something. No, no, no. The people who believed in the evil eye, right, didn't think it was just you giving someone that look, right? No, there was a literal spirit in you behind that look, and that's why the look was so ominous. I mean, that was a literal fetishistic thought, right? Yeah. So again, they're doing this because it's important for us, you know, that live today to try to put ourselves back in the place of those people, right, that took all this stuff very literally. You know, there's literally, right, a spirit inside of the volcano, right? It's a literal fetish, right? There's literally a spirit behind that eye. That's why the eye has power. I mean, no one is believing they have power because of themselves. It isn't humanism, right? It's fetishism. And it's important to remember how literally they took this. And so what a job someone like Moses has, right? I mean, with people that are very simple-minded and very literal-minded, and everything is filled with these literalnesses. I mean, how do you deal with that, right? You know, you remember, even Jesus had to work through this. You know, he had a lot of preconceived opinions, right, when he's making his sixth grade decisions and stuff before his public ministry. Right? But then he actually gets down in the trenches, and it's like, wow, I thought sure that these people had it in them to kind of get a little bit above such simple, literal thinking. No, boy, not even me, with how wonderfully I can say things and what a majestic presence I have and everything, not even I can get them to let go of, right? I mean, I can't even get Peter to let go of these things, let alone Bob in the crowd, right? You know, he had to really face those facts, and he had to compromise, right? He had to bring in some material pragmatism. That's one of the things that Jesus is, you know, as Michael incarnate as Jesus is acquiring, having to bring spiritual idealism and material pragmatism together into a priorly non-existent cosmic consciousness within him. Right? He's having to acquire a cosmic consciousness that he didn't have before. Yeah? In his case, of course, because he's a creator being, it's literalized as literal cosmic deity stuff, but it's still cosmic stuff. It's not something that can be handed to him on the Isle of Paradise. There isn't a pile of that stuff that can get just shoved into him on the Isle of Paradise. You have to come down here and acquire it experientially. You've got to feel the tension between the ideal and the fact. And you've got to work through the wisdom to bring those two together.
Such a technique, it ought to be good enough for us.
Right? Right?
It's good enough for him. Pales me in church, you know, the gospel, the word of the Lord. You know, every word is the word of the Lord.
In the word of the Lord.
Kind of, it's not far off from...
And of course, by Lord, you mean Yahweh, the volcano god.
If you try and contradict that, or even people just...
Right.
They just...
Right. I think it's just too difficult for most people to go beyond a simple literalness. Remember what you know, we've emphasized this many times, how something is effective. It needs to be vivid,
right.
You know, and something that can be, you know, described and taken hold of in very simple fashion, right? Very pithy thing. Vivid and pithy. you know, reality, reasonable, you know, reality-based reasonableness, whatever. Right? I mean, that there's nothing natural about you demanding reality-based or reasonableness to something. What's natural is vivid and simple, you know, to apply.
Which is not what you get in reading.
Yeah, that's, boy, not what you get when you read this puppy, yeah. Right. Especially at times it's like so far removed from that that it's difficult even for the best of us to get our minds around it, right? It's just so not straightforward. Yeah, obviously I'm talking a lot about this because this is kind of one of the main lessons in reading this history about Moses. You know, what's to be gained from rehashing Moses? You know, it's this issue of you've got to face facts, and the facts are brutally not idealistic. Right? They are so not what you were hoping they are, right? And it's just very difficult to come to terms with that. All right. Okay. So we're going through henotheism, and you can see, like I said, you can see that in the Old Testament, moving towards monotheism. What else here?
The idea of Yahweh has undergone the most extensive development of all the mortal theories of God. Its progressive evolution can only be compared with the metamorphosis of the Buddha concept in Asia, which, in the end, led to the concept of the universal absolute, even as the Yahweh concept finally led to the idea of the universal father. But as a matter of historic fact, it should be understood that, while the Jews thus changed their views of deity from the tribal god of Mount Horeb to the loving and merciful creator father of later times, they did not change his name. They continued all the way along to call this evolving concept of deity Yahweh.
Right, so the only comparison is that one we studied here just recently of how far, you know, especially when you finally get to, you know, what becomes personalized as Amida Buddha, right? I mean, that's the only other thing that has such a vast span of evolution. Happened over a shorter span of time, you know, in many ways, but... But still, the Yahweh concept has this strange, vast evolutionary links to it. Now, you may be, you know, as a fifth epical revelation student, notice what they gave you something to chew on here. You're going, whoa, they didn't say that before, which in the end led to the concept of the universal absolute. Yeah, in contrast to the deity absolute, the unqualified absolute. Yeah, the three absolutes. Whereas the Yahweh one got you to the universal father. Not surprising that you would, as we talked about, when you have that very non-personal, amorphous concept that's coming out of Brahmanism, but remember how we talked about when it got into Buddhism, it took on a little bit more of a pregnant character, a little bit more dynamic potential kind of latent. It was a little less innately static. Okay, and when they're saying when you think about it, if you want to kind of identify it with one of the three absolutes of potentiality, think the universal absolute. Because you've got something that's, like I said, it's definitely impersonal, like the universal absolute. But it's not as initially conceptually static as the unqualified absolute. Right? But it also is not. Really to the kind of the spirit end with the deity absolute. It's more in the mind-like domain, right? You've got something. Remember how, you know, some of those people thinking about that kind of amorphous concept got something that's kind of shades of God the Mother, right, or the Supreme, you know, or the Mother. So you see, they're pointing out like this to the universal absolute because you have that kind of mind-like, non-personal fact. But remember, we said the interesting thing, unlike in a lot of more Hindu domains, this non-personal thing could get personalized as Amida Buddha. How do you literally visualize that kind of in the context of the fifth epical revelation? If you have studied any of the total deity issues that you can draw from the revelation, if you take that non-personal element of reality called the universal absolute, and you turn it around from the reality perspective into the deity perspective, you have a facet of deity, the infinite upholder, which is one of the facets of the Father. See? And that's how they kind of see backdoored into the Father by going through the looking glass, as it were, with the universal absolute, turning it around and finding, you know, an aspect of the Father there. You know, and then finding the personal nature of the Father there through. That's the way they got to that. Whereas, with the Yahweh concept, you're just lifting up that anthropomorphic concept more and more and more until you have this kind of supreme individuality that you're thinking in a very personal way, and you can just kind of then take one step to the, to taking that all the way up to absoluteness with the Universal Father. Okay.
Well, you know, then they said they didn't change his name, Yahweh, but I thought Jesus was using, when he was talking about the Father, we're going to discuss it a little bit, I thought he was more referring to El Elyon those days. Remember, we went through this whole dissertation about that?
Yeah, I mean,
as opposed to Yahweh.
Right. Jesus was...
The Father.
Yeah, exactly. See, you know, Jesus would talk directly about the Father, but he was definitely trying to take it beyond what Moses could achieve, move it a little more away from Yahweh and a little bit closer to El Elyon directly than what Moses could do. Yeah, in terms of kind of bringing it into these God names, right? He much more to the El Elyon mode than the Yahweh mode, but attempting to maybe allow for that sort of shifting of a factual way of thinking about God, making it possible, but kind of by transcending it and just talking abstractly about the Father, you know, as opposed to, tying it directly, tying that Father concept directly to a God name, you know, giving them that concept and then letting them kind of get a God name to meet it, right, to rise up to it. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what they were really working with. Are they coming up with their idea of a universal absolute as something that the resolution of all tension? Are they trying to save tension and trying to find trying to resolve that tension so there's then no tension?
Well,
that is the higher thing.
Don't think too deeply technical about what you know about the universal absolute from the Urantia book, but just in a basic conceptual mode first of all, it's not personal, right? So that meets. It's like, you know, making it one of the three absolutes. Okay, fits with that. But like I was trying to motivate a little bit, you know, well, why the universal absolute, not the unqualified absolute or the deity absolute? When you're thinking in that more philosophic mode that they were doing, just like with the Greeks did the exact same thing. You don't get You know, you kind of, you, because you aren't focused enough on religion to really get a personal concept. You know, you're still just in the framing philosophically. You're naturally going to get a mind-like, impersonal concept that you're thinking of. That's, you know, because just that's what's natural with the philosophic, right? The scientific takes you to the unqualified absolute. The religious takes you to the deity absolute, and the philosophic takes you to the universal absolute. And it's just, it's because they're in that philosophic mode, that more wisdom-like, mind-like mode. You know, but instead of kind of, you know, doing a more directly religious route where, see, kind of without thinking about it, you're sort of kind of thinking about the deity absolute, and then you just kind of ball it up and make a god out of it. You know, God is spirit, right? You take that, you know, make some spirit out of it and make a god, personalize that spirit as a god. See, the way it's a trickier thing when you're working with the universal absolute. Like I said, it's not like you can kind of ball it up directly and make it god. You know, it's like, you know, because it's not spirit. So you have to kind of subtly penetrate through, right, and flip it around to the other side and sort of get to deity through the universal absolute. See, when you do that, you get to the infinite upholder, you get to that facet of the Father that in relationship to the Paradise Trinity gets downstepped as a mother, right? You find the mother end, if you will, of the Father. See? You know, in the same way, the Greeks were kind of thinking, when they started to push like this, they were kind of getting God the Mother sort of a concept. Although it was just kind of the Mother, see, and they weren't really personalizing it, but they were kind of getting that universal mind sort of a concept. Because that's what's naturally there when you're thinking philosophically, okay, without bringing it to a point with your religious consciousness. That's all they're trying to get at. That's all they're trying to say.
I was going to argue that point today, mm-hmm, in terms of an impersonal God. Mm-hmm. Because if he was personal, he wouldn't let all these things happen.
Right.
So to speak. So yeah. Especially like here in Boulder, where all the gurus come into town, you know, it's kind of like very popular to have an impersonal, mm-hmm, universal absolute, or, you know, or absolute period, mm-hmm, which, whatever, however you say about it. And when you try to talk to him about, you know, the God has a personality, somebody you can relate to and talk to, oh no. Mm-hmm. It's like, so, but there's truth in that too. I mean, there is truth in the absolute part of,
right,
deity.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just don't argue with them. Right. They'll get it. They'll get it eventually.
Yeah. I remember how they talked about the more India based evolution of this,
yeah,
Brahman like concept. You know, it was getting very, very, you know, intensely into unqualified. You know, it's the unqualified of the unqualified. You know, they're really kind of driving themselves, you know, into that, you know, what's spiritually formless space of the unqualified absolute. Right? It's not materially formless, but it's spiritually formless, right? And it just becomes completely intangible. It's nothing that you could even get a hold of to kind of go through to get to something on the other side. It just becomes completely intangible. Right, when you go that way. But the Buddhist mind, especially in the East, once it got away from India, it actually moved away from that and became more genuinely philosophic, and had a it had a less unqualified aspect to it. Right? On the one end, you have the qualified absolute. On the other end, you have the unqualified absolute. And in the middle, see, you have something that's a little more qualified than the unqualified. So, you know, you're moving towards the qualified. So it has that potential, if you will, that pregnancy in it, or however you want to refer to it, you know, where you could personalize it, see, because it's not as intangible as just thinking, you know, I don't even want to think about it being tangible, because that's a qualification. I got to try to divorce myself from any qualification in order to respect its infinite, you know, intangible mystery. But they didn't drive it so far, you know, coming out of Buddhism. They would let it be just a little bit tangible, right? And that means it drifted from kind of being an unqualified absolute sort of a thing to more of a universal absolute sort of a thing. All right.
That's a cool tangent.
Yeah. See, they just toss that in there, right? See, okay, now for something totally different, let's bring up the universal absolute, right? I mean,
I noticed they toss those terms in these sections a few times.
Yeah. Right.
Just talk about the absolute.
Right. Because they want you to not just think about this in factual historical terms. And all these people, no matter how confused they are, they're pregnant with certain truths. Right, that are finally laid out in detail in this book. Right, and they're trying to help you to see that so that you can respect them for what they were. It's like, okay, they weren't everything, but hey, they were getting the basic essence of the universal absolute. That's better than some. Right.
Two, the Semitic peoples. The Semites of the East were well-organized and well-led horsemen who invaded the eastern regions of the Fertile Crescent, and there united with the Babylonians. The Chaldeans near Ur were among the most advanced of the eastern Semites. The Phoenicians were a superior and well-organized group of mixed Semites who held the western section of Palestine along the Mediterranean coast. Racially, the Semites were among the most blended of all of Urantia peoples, containing hereditary factors from almost all of the nine world races.
Again, it's Chaldean. It's a, These are all just a, you know, a K sound, you know, not a CH sound. The Chaldeans. And remember, the Chaldeans are, you know, the residual of the Sumerians that are still in southern Mesopotamia, you know, down by Ur there, like they're saying.
Who are residuals of?
Yeah, of the Andites and etc. Yes.
Peaceful.
But you can see the point here is, you know, whether or not you're talking about Amorites or Chaldeans or Phoenicians or what have you, in many ways, you end up having lots of flavors of what you can call Semites. Right? Semites that have a little bit of a bias to Mesopotamia, or Semites that have a little bias, you know, this way or the other way. Right? You have this very kind of intangible, in many ways, concept of Semitic peoples. You know, all those different Canaanites, you know, and all the people that Moses is going to lead out, all these different flavor of Semitic peoples. Not only are they diverse, like I've been stressing, like they're pointing out internally, biologically, you know, this is not the mixture of those two races or something. It's kind of everything almost is blended in to these people because they're right in the middle where everything, you know, mixes together there in the Near East, okay? So you have these very blended peoples.
I'm just wondering, today, is there any real difference between what we would consider a Semite and an Arab?
Right. Again, you know, today, right, Israelis and Palestinians are still both Semites, right? You know, they like to think that they're absolutely different. But, of course, biologically, it's just like it's always been, like they're trying to point out here. Okay. It's like, okay, you know, if you could let go of your ideological biases for a second and just, you know, stand next to each other and look in a mirror and go, well, you know, actually, we kind of look like the same people, don't we? Yes. I mean, you know, you know, not only have you been blending for 4,000 years of history that you like to think about, you know, going back to Machiaventa, but you were blending for thousands of years before that, and there's no really that big a difference between an Arab and a, you know, and an Egyptian, and a, you know, Lebanese or whatever. You know, I mean, it's they're all these peoples.
Refresh my memory on the 9 world races.
Well, you got the 6 Sangiks.
Okay, that's easy.
Okay, and then you've got the Andonites. You know, the original race. Then you've got
Andonite, right?
Then you have the Adamites.
Okay, that's 8.
Right, and then you have the Nodites. Okay. You know, and they were all there, right? Nodites and Adamites didn't have to go anywhere to be blending into that, you know, the mix right there. So
Adamson and Rada was a Nodite and an Adamite right there.
Yeah. Right. The whole point is, you know, if you've always kind of been confused about, well, what exactly is a Semite? It's like, well, it's, yeah, I mean, there's a reason why scholars even today have a difficult time pinning it down. It's not really something that you can pin down. It's a very amorphous sort of thing, just kind of indicating those very blended peoples in that region, right, that have kind of a common history, culture, language sort of context.
But they weren't. Completely homogenous,
either. No, they weren't, you know, because they have boundaries, you know, and the Egyptians affect them one way, the Greeks affect them another way, the Sumerians affect them another way, you have these boundary influences that produce differentials, and then they were very tribal, so obviously, you know, that kept, you know, there from being endless blending, you know.
And the red and yellow must have been from way, way back, right?
Right. You know, and, you know, like this is almost all of the 9 world races. Okay, okay. I mean, you're going to, you know, they're not going to have as much as, you know, they're not going to equal of everything. But it's, they're just basically pointing out, don't try to rationalize, well, they're red man. And, okay, because red man thinks like, you know, don't, you just can't think in simple terms like that. It's, you know, they're very blended. And this is one of the reasons why they're a stiff-necked people in general, as you know they're called, because you have all these cross currents within them genetically. It's difficult for them to chill out with all those cross currents inside of them, right? From this hodgepodge, arbitrary blending that they are.
Not much humor.
Right. It's just, you know, they're kind of at odds with themselves. No wonder they're at odds with, you know, each other and everyone else all the time. Right. The war is inside of them genetically.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, it's much easier for the relative pureness of the sons of Han, you know, the yellow race, to get ultra Pacific. Right? They aren't at war with themselves inside. Right, they're very homogeneous inside. Not a lot of cross currents inside. That, you know, these people, it's just nothing but cross currents. Okay.
Again and again, the Arabian Semites fought their way into the northern promised land, the land that flowed with milk and honey. But just as often were they ejected by the better organized and more highly civilized northern Semites and Hittites. Later, during an unusually severe famine, these roving Bedouins entered Egypt in large numbers as contract laborers on the Egyptian public works, only to find themselves undergoing the bitter experience of enslavement at the hard daily toil of the common and downtrodden laborers of the Nile Valley.
Another one of those boundaries there that they're mentioning on the Semites is the Hittites on the north side in Asia Minor. And remember, there's a lot of Andonite genetics in that what we now call Turkey, you know, in that Asia Minor region way back in the day. So you've got that again, yes. And the whole Fertile Crescent thing, you know, is very much thought like that when you're down in the depths of the Arabian Peninsula,
the desert,
and you're pining for the land flowing with milk and honey to the north, right? So just the obvious, you know, geographic setting that they're dealing with there. You know, like I said, you know, even if you don't go way down in the Arabian Peninsula, you know, because it's a fertile crescent, right, up Mesopotamia and down along the Mediterranean coast, just that area in between, the Arabs in the northern regions, but in between there, you know, they're constantly looking to the west and the east. It's like, ooh, we should try to take over Mesopotamia, you know, from the Sumerians, and you know, they'll do it for a little while, and then they'll get shoved out, and you know, et cetera. So there's all this rattling around because of the geographic differences that are in play there. All right, but you know, obviously we're setting up Moses here. Yeah. But so eventually you get a bunch of them that you know, are basically willing to put themselves into hard labor in all the endless Egyptian public works projects because they were hungry.
Yeah, okay. Climate did
something. Right, climate had a lot to do with it, right? Yeah. Yep. If it wasn't for climate change, you wouldn't have ended up with Moses.
I wonder what this change is going to bring.
I'd get shot if I had that as a bumper sticker.
Why do
you
get shot these days?
Anyway, let's keep going.
It was only after the days of Machiavelli to Melchizedek and Abraham that certain tribes of Semites, because of their peculiar religious beliefs, were called the children of Israel, and later on Hebrews, Jews, and the chosen people. Abraham was not the racial father of all the Hebrews. He was not even the progenitor of all the Bedouin Semites who were held captive in Egypt. True, his offspring coming up out of Egypt did form the nucleus of the later Jewish people, but the vast majority of the men and women who became incorporated into the clans of Israel had never sojourned in Egypt. They were merely fellow nomads who chose to follow the leadership of Moses as the children of Abraham and their Semite associates from Egypt journeyed through northern Arabia.
Oh boy. The nice tidy story in the Old Testament, see, just isn't isn't as told. Yes. Yeah, you're talking blasphemy here, right? Yeah, the neat, tidy 12 tribes of Israel and all that. No, okay. But you know, okay. Notice that they're bringing in some of these terms. Yeah, you know, the children of Israel. You know, so going from Jacob to him being called Israel, because he wrestled with the Lord. You know, and there's the El. Remember, we read the El thing, Israel. Right, there's God. Right, you know, he wrestled with God. Gene asked me last week, it's like, well, what about this, what's the difference between Hebrews and Jews? So you notice they're bringing that up, and they put them in that order even. I mean, basically, you know, think of Hebrew as an older and more collective-like term. I mean, obviously the word Jew, you know, has an innate bias inherent in it that Hebrew doesn't, because where's Jew coming from? Judah, right? The one of the 12 tribes, right? And even when you blend in, you know, Benjamin, you know, and you've got, you know, the southern kingdom, right, of Judea, you see, so they're pointing out, you've got that. You've got a, as they mentioned there, that sort of bias is inherent there. What did they say? But the vast majority. Before that, true, his offspring coming out of Egypt did form the nucleus of the later Jewish people. And notice, see, they even said Jewish people there. Right. So you've got some of the less ragtag accumulation parts, kind of a more nucleus part that is tied more directly to Abraham, right? And that you can kind of say that's sort of the Jewish nucleus of the Hebrew people. But we all know that when they started carting people off to Babylon, they carted off the northern kingdom. They carted off Israel first, and Judea, and Judah second. You got to figure out whether you want to say it in kind of Jesus Roman terms or older terms, and what names you give to these peoples, but in these regions, but anyway, you've got that. Where's Jerusalem? It's in the southern kingdom, not the northern kingdom. All that sort of stuff, kind of gets you to evolve a lot to just calling them Jews rather than Hebrews. Even if you have, they speak Hebrew, right? Still.
Wasn't the northern kingdom pretty much completely undone?
Yeah, right. Yeah. All those issues, just that you can think about. Just think about how different it was the way Jesus' apostles thought about the peoples of the one time northern kingdom compared to the peoples of the one time southern kingdom. Right? Those Samaritans, were not thought of on the same par. Or Galileans. even more so, right? Yeah, what good can come out of that place? Right, so all that is involved in the contrast between Hebrew and those names, Hebrew and Jew. not to mention, I bet if they called themselves the chosen people, everyone else on the planet won't feel any tension with that. Probably won't lead to any problems in Europe. So we all know how this this plays out.
Chosen a lot,
right?
Targeted,
and of course, we chuckle about this, but that's only if we kind of look at it like the celestials look at it, where they're saying, well, they've got to die of something, whatever, but of course, the reality is millions and millions of people, have gone through horrors and whatnot for centuries and millennia because of all these issues that we kind of joke about. There's a lot of human suffering behind all this. But part of it, you're not laughing at them. You're laughing at the sorry state of barely human fancy animals and all of their shenanigans, that is us. This is just, we need to be objective about ourselves. This is what the reversion directors try to get you to do, to be able to look at these things and chuckle, right? And not get all worked up about, but people died and it's horrible, don't you dare laugh at it, No, the reversion directors are trying to get you to step back from it and see it for the silly doings of primitive little, basically, animals, right, that we are, right? And turn away from that and look towards greater things. All right. Anything else there? Isn't it interesting that not only is it a hodgepodge actually in Egypt that Moses takes out, but then you got a whole bunch of people who's like, this looks like an interesting thing. Let's join with this group here. And so as they're out wandering around for years and years, they're like a snowball rolling around in the desert, accumulating more and more peoples. So it's a interesting phenomenon. It's not that. Again, see, obviously this very complicated story couldn't be inspiring for a people in exile in Babylon. You needed to clean up this whole story, right? And so those that wrote the Old Testament during the exile, created this neat, tidy story that's definitively a chosen people story. There's no arbitrary ragtagness, It's all very definitive and God-directed. Right. But you're reminded of just how far those authors of the Old Testament had to take the story from what was actually in their history books that they were working with. Is this whole complicated story, and they needed to boil it down, to something that could inspire a depressed people, in exile. Okay.
The Melchizedek teaching concerning El Elyon, the Most High, and the covenant of divine favor through faith had been largely forgotten by the time of the Egyptian enslavement of the Semite peoples who were shortly to form the Hebrew nation. But throughout this period of captivity, these Arabian nomads maintained a lingering traditional belief in Yahweh as their racial deity.
Okay, so, you know, in bigger terms, the whole God Most High concept is a young upstart. So it doesn't have as much enduring power as the old traditional Yahweh. So, you know, they're pointing out that that's going to take a lot longer to fade away than those new teachings from Machaventa. And so, you know, Moses isn't going to have a solid El Elyon, you know, God idea, people with that idea to work with. And he's going to have, he's basically Yahweh's all he's got to work with. You know, and it's as simplistic as a golden or a silver calf, right, idol. All right.
Yahweh was worshipped by more than 100 separate Arabian tribes, and except for the tinge of the El Elyon concept of Melchizedek, which persisted among the more educated classes of Egypt, including the mixed Hebrew and Egyptian stocks, the religion of the rank and file of the Hebrew captive slaves was a modified version of the old Yahweh ritual of magic and sacrifice.
Yeah, filled with magic and sacrifice. And again, just Yahweh was worshipped by more than 100 separate Arabian tribes. Right? So you can just, you know, there's that many different flavors of Yahweh ritual. So it's not only primitive, but it's just, see, you go, wow, this is reminding me a lot of what Chris was saying about what the Kaaba shrine was like before Muhammad, right, with its 360 different tribal deities. And yeah, it's the same people, so of course it's the same, right? Right, it's just some of those peoples got whipped into monotheism earlier than others. But you're starting with the same almost hopeless situation. You're going to have to be very vigorous with these people, right? Like Muhammad and Moses were, if you're going to get anywhere from this menagerie situation, right? I mean, yeah. Think of how much easier it would be if they all had, were on the same page with Yahweh anyway, even though Yahweh was a primitive notion. But yeah, you know, he doesn't even have that. He's got every different flavor of what they think Yahweh is. It's about as many flavors as people. It's a very, very difficult situation. The boy is going to have a lot of material pragmatism if he's going to get anywhere with this. Right? There's no purity handle here to grab a hold of, right? You're as far away from purity as you can get.
So how many Yahwehs?
What?
Such a Yahwehs. I think of how many separate Christian tribes there are.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Probably close to 100, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, and just that's the natural tendency. And it's they're kind of pointing out when you've got all this different genetic mishmash with these peoples, kind of our naturalness is all the more on display, right? A very pure race can appear to be more enlightened than they really are, just because you go, oh, they're all kind of going in the same direction. They're all so pure, But you sort of notice that most and ignore the fact that yeah, but this so-called purity that they're all on the same page with is very savage and primitive. When you have all these cross currents genetically, you know, it's easier to kind of face the facts that these people are just natural, right? And anything that you try to give them that's unnatural will be a stark non sequitur. They're just, it's going to be like Jesus talking to the apostles, right? He's jiggling air molecules, but nothing is happening inside the apostles' heads, right? I mean, it just, everything he's saying is just so non sequitur to the natural place that their minds is. He's saying all these very unnatural things, and they just, they're looking, and it's like, I really love him, but I don't have the slightest idea what he's talking about. You know, they just, and Moses is going to face the exact same thing. He's going to talk to him, and they're just going to look at him with doe eyes. They can't figure out anything he's talking about, right? Things that for us are just very simple to understand are completely incomprehensible to them. The simplest God idea that we all take for granted. It's like, well, little kids believe that. You couldn't get, you know, anybody back then to think a simple thought like you can get a 3-year-old to think today. And it was just so different.
So he'd have to do, Moses would have to do lots of reflecting on what was the most important thing that he wanted to accomplish, mm-hmm. and get real creative about what's the simplest way to help lead people to that.
Yeah.
And just don't worry about the rest.
Exactly. Right. You've got to pick your battles. A lot of things you just got to let be. Right? It's like, okay, there's one main thing I want to get done. Okay. How can I get to there? Let's not worry about all this other stuff. Exactly. Right. Yeah. You've got to be pragmatic about it. Yeah. All right. And there's just been so few people that had a significant religious consciousness in all of human history that could be pragmatic, right? Like we've been reading. Akhenaten couldn't do it. Right? Moses could do it. Abner couldn't do it. Paul could do it, etc. Right.
3, the matchless Moses. The beginning of the evolution of the Hebraic concepts and ideals of a supreme creator dates from the departure of the Semites from Egypt under that great leader, teacher, and organizer, Moses. His mother was of the royal family of Egypt. His father was a Semite liaison officer between the government and the Bedouin captives. Moses thus possessed qualities derived from superior racial sources. His ancestry was so highly blended that it is impossible to classify him in any one racial group. Had he not been of this mixed type, he would never have displayed that unusual versatility and adaptability which enabled him to manage the diversified horde which eventually became associated with those Bedouin Semites who fled from Egypt to the Arabian desert under his leadership.
Okay, before we talk about all the elements in there, notice the one little thing that ties in what we were just stressing about all these cross currents, all this racial blending. Okay, in an exceptional individual, if they've got enough uplifting, there's a place within them, a more objective place, that they really can plant their feet. And then all of that diversity, genetic diversity, and kind of mind flexibility because of it, they can use that as a complex toolbox, all sorts of different tools in it. You know, they can kind of get how those people are thinking and how those people are thinking. You know, they can take their mind in many directions, but that's only because they've got this stable, transcendent vantage point within them, you know, to look down on them. You know, when you're down in the midst of all that, you're just at war with yourself. Okay. See, so that's, he's got the same mix, but he's got enough upstepping, biologic upstepping, that he can stand above the internal war. And instead of becoming a negative, it becomes a positive. right? It flips 180 degrees. And gives him versatility and adaptability that he wouldn't have had it if he'd been a purebred of some sort. Which is an interesting thing. And remember, that's part of the inherent experiment on this decimal world, that you had that Andonite race, quote-unquote pre-blended race, to start all the Sangiks out with a will creature mindal context that had all of that versatility and adaptability, like they're saying there, kind of inherently in it. So that you weren't as limited as a red man normally is. You weren't as limited as an indigo man normally is on a world that doesn't have a pre-Sangic race. That was one of the points of this world. So you can kind of see the essence of that, see, playing out here. You upstep from that, like Adam and Eve were supposed to do to all of us, and you've got a diversity down there that gives you potentials that peoples on normal worlds don't have. And Moses is kind of taking advantage of that. It's obviously not as homogeneous a foundation as would have had if there hadn't been a default and everything, but still, right, he's not a one-trick pony, right, genetically. Okay. Now in terms of Moses himself, remember back when we were talking about Machiavelli and Melchizedek, they said in terms of the Kenites that Machiavelli was engaging there. The members of the family of Catro, with whom Melchizedek lived for more than 30 years, knew many of these higher truths and long perpetuated them in their family, even to the days of their illustrious descendant Moses. Right? So, right, that's coming down, that they mentioned way back there, see, on Moses' father's side. Okay. So you've got that influence feeding directly in with Moses' father. And, his mother has got some decent genetics with the royal family also. And there's Melchizedek's teachings had a lot of impact amongst the better minds in Egypt as well. Right? So he's going to get El Elyon from both his mother and his father in kind of slightly different ways.
This period before the universe of the school of thought adjusters, it might be just my idea, but it appears that these family lines seem to have more linearity, staying power, than might be possible today.
We're even losing kind of among some of the better families on the planet today. You're even kind of losing that sense of there's a nobility in that family line and that needs to be conserved. More and more it's like, oh, whatever, you know, we're all born equal. Let's just, you know, mate with anything that moves. Definitely in the ancient past it was very strong tendencies like that. Not only kind of a genetic sense that the people had about themselves, but as I mentioned earlier, you've got the basic tribal sense too, that there's your tribe and you mate within your tribe and you don't mate with those other tribes. It wasn't an absolute, because biology is biology. We all know how this works, right? But still, that the tribal taboos would reinforce that some too, kind of beyond the clan, or family nobility senses.
It just seems like there's just a greater sense of difference.
Yeah.
Because some families wouldn't have that adjuster influence in them. And the ones that did, it would be more clearly obvious that there's a difference.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, great point. I mean, those family lines that actually, you know, had adjusters, you know, where the children were getting adjusters at roughly age six and everything because their parents had an adjuster. Yeah, I mean, those, you know, think about how much more so better genetics was amplified back before the universal bestowal of thought adjusters. Yeah, if you had poor genetics and there had been lots of unfortunate mating and it actually severed that, where the only way someone in that family line was going to get an adjuster is they would rise up to be one of those prerequisites, like becoming a third circler or something. Yeah, I mean, boy, the limited genetics there with no focusing agent to kind of make it appear better than it really is, you know, an adjuster, So the class differences were all the more stark back then because of the non-universality of adjusters. Exactly, yeah. You know, remember when Cain got an adjuster, that really put him a notch above a lot of people, right? He has many blind spots as Cain had, right, nonetheless. Okay.
He ended up being more able.
Yeah, that's a bad one. It made Cain more able. Ah, groaner. Okay.
It's out of the way, though. Good news. You see Tom Choquette's joke about Yahweh today?
So they're pointing out Moses, he has this superior racial sources, you know, this higher genetics. And the reason I already explained, you know, that bit that he kind of had a place to stand above all of the mismatch of genetics, and he could, instead of it being a negative, turned it, that diversity, into a positive. All right. Anything else there? Nope, let's keep going.
Despite the enticements of the culture of the Nile kingdom, Moses elected to cast his lot with the people of his father. At the time this great organizer was formulating his plans for the eventual freeing of his father's people, the Bedouin captives hardly had a religion worthy of the name. They were virtually without a true concept of God and without hope in the world.
Oh, that's awful. Yeah. There's a reason why I said, you know, basically hopeless before. They're saying the same thing there. And notice how they're being much more precise, you know, in saying hardly had a religion worthy of the name. As we've talked about so many times, you know, we're calling a lot of stuff religion, but, okay, it's not religion. In fact, it's only religion in truth, right? Super consciously. Right? Here they're pointing out, sure, you could call these people religious like some of our previous papers have been, but, okay, let's be serious here. There's almost no shadows of the superconscious religious fact that are in play at all, right? Even as shadows, let alone substance. So without a true concept of God, so this kind of gets back to talking about the universal absolute and stuff, you know, with the Buddhists. See, I mean, notice that it's not just the unfortunate thing in the East with Brahmanism and stuff like that. I mean, it's not very natural to have any sort of a God thing. It's pretty natural to have nature spirits, but God? No, that doesn't happen, you know, in the most primitive peoples, just naturally. Remember, we read about that. It took a long time to kind of get to something that you could kind of call capital G God of
these
any sort.
The Bedouins are the guys who, because they had all drought in their country, moved down to get jobs and then became slaves.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not paying you anymore. You're doing this work for free.
Well,
where's my milk and honey? They didn't come from
Wilkin. Yes. And you have to kind of chuckle. Moses elected to cast his lot, right? The whole bit about his chance and stuff, you know. Yeah. Just kind of reminding you between the lines of how much that sort of thinking is still in play, too, right? Right, all the magical, you know, the good luck, bad luck, you know, spirits and demons, and, you know, it's all just a, yeah, pretty primitive state of affairs. Okay.
No leader ever undertook to reform and uplift a more forlorn, downcast, dejected, and ignorant group of human beings. But these slaves carried latent possibilities of development in their hereditary strains, and there were a sufficient number of educated leaders who had been coached by Moses in preparation for the day of revolt and for the strike for liberty to constitute a core of efficient organizers. These superior men had been employed as native overseers of their people. They had received some education because of Moses' influence with the Egyptian rulers.
The material pragmatism. Right. He's not just getting a wild hair one day and trusting God, right? No, he's laying out lots of methodical plans, years of preparation, getting a core group of people educated enough that there was something between their ears, right? It could be deputies, et cetera, right? He's planning it all out.
God gave me a mind, let me use it.
And, and if you have desires to go out and lead people out of their darkness, you can take solace in the fact that no leader ever undertook to reform and uplift a more forlorn, downcast, dejected, and ignorant group of human beings. don't you think you got an ignorant mass to face?
Don't show this to the Palestinians.
Yeah, if you talk to Moses, you go, oy vey, let me tell you about right? You ain't seen ignorant until you saw the batch I had.
You're so ignorant, they're ignorant.
Right.
He earned his title matchless.
Yes. So he needed all of the genetic and kind of revelatory influence he could get to take on this task.
And also educated.
Yeah. Yeah, the best education you could get back in those days, basically, right? And it's all coming together.
This is over a period of time. Where's the quote on 40 years of watchful waiting? Jesus made that quote, right? Did Moses have 40 years of watchful waiting?
We'll get to the 40 years thing in just a bit.
It did take a while. Right? did this for over a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious this is a long span of time, yeah.
What do you want, fill in the blank?
Yeah, yes. I got this notion. Let's just do it today. Yeah, right. The amount of patience. See again, just until you have the spiritual idealism and the material pragmatism that your seventh adjutant can put one in each of the two scales and you can weigh them. You know, consider them back and forth with your seventh adjutant. There's no way that you could be patient, right? The seventh adjutant is where the patience comes in. Right? And as you go up the levels of meaning, that's where the seventh adjutant is in the middle. That's the level of patience. Right? See, and just notice kind of one of those predicates as I'm trying to point out to how do you get to patience? You need to get the seventh adjutant just as the energy of symmetry. Right? It's basic energy nature. You have to get it working, functioning. It means there has to be two things that you can play off of each other, so you can consider balance and proportion. Right? If you just have the single-minded grip of your sixth adjutant, right? There's no playing like that. There can't be any patience. Right? Just how do you get from the sixth up to the seventh? Right? You have to give facts a chance. You have to give pragmatism a chance. Right? If you reject such things in the name of purity, like your sixth adjunct wants you to do, you'll never get there. And you're gonna have all those signs. What do you want? Fill in the blank. When do you want it? Now. Right? Yep.
I just realized, I guess they do prepare and organize, don't they? These
people with the signs. What does that mean? Yeah, but it's kind of on the spur of the moment, right? I mean, especially when you see the hand-scrawled signs, you know, they just did it that morning, yeah. This wasn't years of planning. Yes, especially, you know, if you can just kind of white out the, you know, fill in the blank one and put the new thing in there. Use the same sign from last year. all right, let's see. Wait, before we go on, getting off on these tangents.
So that's really the big hedge for the vivid propensity is a more seventh adjunct orientation.
Right. I mean, you can't. Yeah, you can't get to reasonableness, let alone reality, right, until you first go, well, let's see, on the one hand I've got this, and on the other hand I've got this. I need to consider this. And until you're doing that, and basic, kind of just fanciest animal usage of the seventh adjunct, right, you can't get up there, you know, let alone eventually come back down and use it as the spirit of wisdom, right, in a more top-down sense. all right. Okay, and I'm looking here again. I think we got everything there, didn't we? I was going to mention. It's not like the sixth adjunct doesn't have its place. In preparation for the day of revolt and the strike for liberty. Okay. I mean, there's that energization. There's that religious impulse. Okay. But it's not the only voice.
It's tempered.
Okay. All right. There's a bridle on that. Okay. And you'll see the fact that there's a bridle on it, he's going to pull back on the reins here in a second.
Moses endeavored to negotiate diplomatically for the freedom of his fellow Semites. He and his brother entered into a compact with the king of Egypt, whereby they were granted permission peaceably to leave the valley of the Nile for the Arabian desert. They were to receive a modest payment of money and goods in token of their long service in Egypt. The Hebrews, for their part, entered into an agreement to maintain friendly relations with the pharaohs and not to join in any alliance against Egypt. But the king later saw fit to repudiate this treaty, giving as his reason the excuse that his spies had discovered disloyalty among the Bedouin slaves. He claimed they sought freedom for the purpose of going into the desert to organize the nomads against Egypt.
Okay, so, Moses is all this inside, you know, with the pharaoh. And so he puts together this fantastic arrangement. I mean, they're going to receive a modest payment of money and goods in token of their long service in Egypt and everything, in the moment reparations. And, it approached it diplomatically, okay, all this. But remember, naturally, humans are quite tribal and suspicious of other tribes. And so, when all is said and done, the Pharaoh just, I don't know, I've got this nagging suspicion about these others, right? They're others after all. Can I really trust them? You know, I'm pretty sure this is all just a clever ruse. Because obviously, you know, leaders like the Pharaohs are innately insecure. You know, they know everyone is trying to stab them in the back, you know, all the time.
Because it happens
all the time, right? You know, once every 50 pharaohs, you know, they live more than 5 years, right? That's the lot of kings back in the day, right? But you know, notice that, again, all of that, all the wisdom it takes, right, for him to negotiate this whole thing, and how patient he is and all that. So it's even though this didn't work out immediately here with the Pharaoh, he'll have this ability to bring those tools to bear with this ragtag bunch he's going to finally leave with. And I'll just point out, see, in this first sentence that we're about to read next, notice, like I said, he has a bridle on that sixth adjutant. You know, it's not just damn the torpedoes full speed ahead. You know, when this happens, you go, okay, let's pull back on the reins. Right? We're not going to go sallying forth into the desert quite yet here. And let's you know, reset things and figure out how we're going to work with the situation as it is. You know, he doesn't start a revolution against the Pharaoh because of this or anything. You know, he doesn't just double down on his sixth adjutant. He pulls back on its reins. So he's got what he definitely has what it takes to be matchless when all is said and done. See,
but there was some truth here in terms of, you know, it said a second ago they were getting ready for a revolt and strike. So Pharaoh's spies probably picked up on that because, you know, they're talking about it or whatever, and then he kind of got suspicious. So if it's chronological,
well, but you know, see, he's. He has that initial spark, of let my people go, right?
Starts to negotiate.
Yeah. See,
and
yeah.
Then they find out, well, he's been talking on this side over here.
Right. See, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, so your point is well taken. I mean, it's not like the Pharaoh doesn't know the way most people are. It's like he knows that, you know, this started out with them, champing at the bit, right? You know, being restless, right, in their slavery. And so, yeah, sure, Moses puts on this very calm, negotiative face to it and everything, but right, there's a reason why he can be suspicious. It's why any of us should, you know, trust but verify when we're engaging others, right? I mean, because there's that sixth adjutant can slip its bridle in any of us. Right, and that person can take off on a tear.
And here again is the nomads that they said ended up following him.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. See, and the Pharaoh knows that if, you know, once they get out there, there's all these other peoples. There's a lot of potential. If someone is, he knows how great a leader Moses is, and he's thinking, I'll bet you a lot of people are going to rally around him, and what if this all turns back around on me, you know, right? He knows that Moses is Pharaoh quality.
Yeah, that's true.
Yep.
But Moses was not discouraged. He bided his time, and in less than a year, when the Egyptian military forces were fully occupied in resisting the simultaneous onslaughts of a strong Libyan thrust from the south and a Greek naval invasion from the north, this intrepid organizer led his compatriots out of Egypt in a spectacular night flight. This dash for liberty was carefully planned and skillfully executed, and they were successful, notwithstanding that they were hotly pursued by Pharaoh and a small body of Egyptians, who all fell before the fugitives' defense, yielding much booty, all of which was augmented by the loot of the advancing host of escaping slaves as they marched on towards their ancestral desert home.
Okay, so he goes to plan B. Okay, we are going to have to make a dash for it. And he just waits for, you know, he plans very carefully for just such a kind of a bolt, you know, out of there.
The Red Sea was ready to part, right?
Yeah. He kind of waited for that Red Sea parting kind of like thing, you know. It's like, oh, well, most of the army is engaged with the Libyans and the Greeks here, right? Right. So, yeah, so you can kind of see how, pardon the pun with the Red Sea. You can kind of see how some of those elements of the story in the Bible, even though they aren't literally historical facts, they're not totally divorced from kind of some of the dynamics that went on. See, mm-hmm.
Do you think he actually wiped out the Pharaoh?
Yeah. See, so I was going to point that out. Notice that the Pharaoh and his little band here that weren't that he could spare from engaging the Greeks and the Libyans. Moses and crew killed them all. And so there's some clues here. Remember I told you historians don't have all the dating of all this stuff, figured out. We know that Moses died at about 1500. Remember, from another spot in the book. Okay, and so with these clues about what this Pharaoh was facing with attacks from the Greeks and the Libyans, you ought to be able to figure out which Pharaoh this was. See, get kind of in a close ballpark, knowing kind of a little bit better exactly, when Moses lived instead of 200 years after that or something. Right, so you're totally playing with the incorrect batch of pharaohs trying to figure it out. Right, you've got this immediate batch of pharaohs in there that you can consider and look in the. The Egyptians kept lots of records about all their wars and stuff. And so I'm sure this is enough clues to figure out exactly which pharaoh Moses was dealing with. So there's a little bit of, again, clues there to sort out the whole chronology of all this and stuff.
Well, talk about booty and loot.
Booty and loot, yes.
Yeah. I mean, these weren't idealists.
Pirates.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, right? They when we say they need some pragmatism to go along with their idealism, they don't think your kind of idealism, okay? Right. I mean, there wasn't an emergency that led to a revelation like this one back then, because of untempered idealism. Like we have now. I mean, the idealism was relative to the time.
How many people do you think this was? Do you have any idea?
I don't recall if they give us any clues. Yeah. It obviously was a pretty big number to begin with because they had no problem in dealing with Pharaoh and his soldiers. But then, as they start heading out, they, gather more and more and more. So by the time they're encamped, by the volcano, it's probably a pretty big crew of people, right? let's see here. What else do we need to bring out there? Notice, Moses knew that when his whole kind of civilized plan broke down with the negotiated peace, he knew he wouldn't have to wait long. He knows how much warring and stuff, and he knew there would be a time in the not too distant future when there would be enough distraction in play that he could just get out of Dodge. And it was literally less than a year. So, but I'm sure he was kind of delighted it wasn't 2 weeks later, because he needed some time to really plan this. It's like, okay, boy, if we've got to bolt out of here, that's a whole different logistics than, everyone waving goodbye and wishing us fond farewells and whatnot, So, and doing it in the night, racing off into the dark, they don't have flashlights or anything, right? This is complicated. So, I'm sure he was glad he had enough time to plan all the logistics of that. The Pharaoh did end up dead, even though he wasn't washed over by the Red Sea.
And you wonder, they're being attacked by the Libyans from the south, and then the other people.
The Greeks from the north.
Greeks from the north, and then the Pharaoh gets killed. So, what happened to that government? Did Egypt just fall?
Oh, no. there was always someone ready to take the reins and be the next Pharaoh.
That's true.
Yeah, that happened many, many, many times, and Egypt kept going and going and going. So, that wouldn't have been cataclysmic.
He could have just as easily been thwarted by any of the other issues that were attackers.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of attackers there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you notice that this is old school stuff. I mean, it's not like today where the leader stays in his cozy, little room and watches it on TV while his soldiers go to battle. The Pharaoh is out there with them.
Yeah.
Back in the days when the chief was on the white horse at the front of the charge, And again, before we wrap it up here, in juxtaposition to what you brought out about the booty and the loot and, all of that, focus on we need material things, you can't just, go out in the desert and live magically, right? You're going to need some wealth. In contrast to that was, notice that they said it again, this dash for liberty. Okay, yes, you see, it's not, well, one time they say it, but yeah, they repeated it. They want you to think, okay, there really is a tension between the inner life, the domain of liberty, and their lack of freedom in the outer life, right? And they're feeling that tension. You don't so much notice if you're free or a slave in the outer life, if there's no inner life sense of liberty, right, to be in tension with it. The challenge is, the tension is automatic when you're actually in bondage in the outer life, right, and feel that tension with liberty in your inner life. And that tension is important. There's a super additive consequence that you need to achieve between the inner and the outer. It's actually more difficult. What if you aren't in bondage in the outer life? What if you have relative social freedom in the outer life? So you don't immediately feel that tension. Will you even know you have an inner life, will the inner life just fade from consciousness, and you become totally just wrapped up, right, in the comforts of the material comfort era and all its freedoms in the outer life?
Well, okay. You can also not value freedom and actually allow yourself to become enslaved. Mm-hmm. They went to Egypt because they were hungry,
right,
and fell into servitude.
Mm-hmm.
We can fall into servitude today.
We already have.
There's tax slavery and there's all kinds of things, right? Besides literal shackles bondage. Yeah, but see that's inevitably there. I'm trying to point out, you free yourself from literal shackle bondage. Don't be surprised if circumstances get you into bondage again, because there's the inevitabilities, right? You have to have that contrast between the two things on either side of then must. There's the part of the inner life before the then must, but then there's the outer life stuff after the then must, right? There's a vast conspiracy to get you to have this tension, because the whole point is to have an inner life that stands in contrast to the outer life, to be unnatural, right? And all of the potential there. So, anyway, it's just all of that is kind of hidden in the way they're talking about it here. There's an inner life desire. And the degree to which you have a people with some inner life desires, based upon that, or kind of embodied in that word liberty, there are people that Moses could do something with, right? Because the same domain that knows liberty can know God. Right? Now, and like I said, if you get so comfortable with your outer life, right, that you move away from the domain of liberty and hence from God, then you get in the state of a secular people, right? That something out there becomes the God.
Play golf every day.
Yeah. Whatever it is. Right? Just notice that. That's one of the difficult challenges, and because we're failing that challenge, that's why there's an emergency. That's what's here. It's trying to, it's, you know, they've got the inevitabilities right up front. They're trying, you know, it's supposed to be a contrast. People, stop trying to somehow make it so there isn't. If you eliminate human inequality, there's no contrast. So that, but that's difficult for our idealistic mind to countenance. You know, that just seems wrong. I mean, like you were saying a little bit ago, I mean, what kind of a God would allow that? See, you know, you're taking your sense of purity, personifying that, exalting that as a God, and having God look at it just the same way you are, you know.
So there is no God.
Yeah, so therefore there is no God, because the outer life isn't pure, right? It's a
God wouldn't allow that.
Right, it's just very problematic. It's like, no, God's the author of that, okay?
We're not done with Moses yet.
It's like, he more than allows it, he authored it, right? All that stuff then must, that's the providence of God, right? I mean, God is the author of all that, all those difficulties after the then musts and the inevitabilities.
Tempt the angels.
Right. Anyway, okay, so we'll continue on next time here. We got a lot more about Moses to do. I hope that I hope you got that. You can see that there's a lot more here than just the history of Moses to think about. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.